Saxes old do 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 Saxes old do 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 Saxes old do 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 Saxes
almost dead.
J Cal's fat do 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 J Cal's fat do 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 do
J Cal's not fat anymore. He's getting the cannons back.
Do 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 Friedberg's not human, he's a robot, he's a robot, he's a robot.
Don't quit your day job, Jamal, that's all I can say.
Bro, you don't remember Baby Shark? I mean, how many...
No, he doesn't know his kids' first names or birthdays. How does he know Baby Shark?
Let your winners ride.
Rain Man David Sack.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 55 of the All In Podcast. With us again this week, the dictator himself, Chamath Palihapitiya, the queen of quinoa, David Friedberg, and coming back from Portugal and the Solana conference, riding his...
Where heroin and prostitution are legal.
David Sacks. We were gonna double click on that, but you jumped the gun here on the docket. So, David, how was the heroin in Portugal?
Great.
Great. Okay. There you have it, folks.
I was fully drinking the Kool-Aid at the Solana conference. It wasn't heroin, it was Kool-Aid.
It was literally Kool-Aid. How many people were at the Solana conference in Portugal? Why is it in Portugal? What happens at a Solana crypto conference?
I think there were thousands of people there, and it was, I mean, easily. And it was kind of a madhouse, and people were trying to get in last minute. Nobody could get in because the conference was like totally sold out. It was a lot of crypto developers, a lot of people with projects. Mm. And why Portugal? I think because there's a lot of conferences happening in Portugal right now because they are easier on the COVID restrictions than a lot of other countries. So you can actually get in there and host a conference.
What was it, indoors with no masks?
Or masks optional? I can't remember if like masks were required or not. I did see people wearing masks indoors. So
were you required to be vaccinated? Did they do tests I
did
on the way
show,
in?
I think I did show a vaccine pass at one point when I checked in.
I just did my booster.
I'm going to do my booster shortly.
It was a little, I would say, the same kind of shitty feeling as the second one.
Hmm. Which kind, though?
I just got Pfizer. I mean, I had the first two were Pfizer, so I took Pfizer. She was the nurse actually gave me a choice. She's like, you can do whatever you want, Pfizer, Moderna, or J&J. I didn't know any better. I texted my doctor. So I just took Pfizer. Although the interesting thing is Moderna is the only one that's dose regulated for the third dose. So there's they actually give you less specifically, but Pfizer is the same for all
three. I think we talked about this on the pod. There's one theory which they told you get whatever one you can get was the instructions because it's more important to just get one than which one you get. But they said there's a Swiss cheese theory, which is if you took two slices of Swiss cheese from two different bricks of it, the holes would not be the same. And therefore, you overlap them. So whichever deficiencies each one had, maybe the other one doesn't.
So I should have gotten Moderna is what you're saying.
That would be, if you believe in the Swiss cheese theory, I don't know, Friedberg, you're a science guy.
I should ask Aaron Rodgers what he thinks.
I mean, he just straight up lied about being vaccinated, huh?
I think so. And I think the NFL is not doing anything about it. Yeah.
That's not cool. Why would you lie about it? I mean, he would have still been allowed to play. So there was no reason to lie about it. I'm not totally up on that story. The rumor is that Kyrie is going to be playing basketball soon because
Eric Adams is going to lift the vaccine restrictions.
You will not need to show a vaccine card or wear a mask.
Bro,
Maybe he'll just get a PCR test every day.
I don't think it's going to matter because the Warriors are shooting the lights out and Klay hasn't even come back yet. And so
that Gary Payton, the second.
Did you see Gary? Did you see Gary Payton? Yeah, Junior. These clips.
Oh my God. I mean, he's animal. Like living above the rim and destroying it. Weissman's back, and then Wiggins is playing great basketball. I mean, the Warriors are going to win this year. I don't know.
Steph is otherworldly right now.
Yeah, I think Steph's got something to prove, even though he doesn't, but he's playing like he's got something to prove. Okay, so do we want to just cover the elephant in the room? The last episode, I think we should just get out of the way because it relates to Solana. We took something out of the last podcast so people understand we have an agreement between the four of us. if there's something that somebody doesn't want on the pod after we record it, we'll take it out because we don't want anybody. I mean, I think the philosophy, we haven't said this out loud, is we don't want anybody to say something they regret that could cause damage to other people or to themselves. So if they want to take something out that they said, that's fine with all of us. And basically each of us has veto right on something. So last week, two people took their veto right on something and we took something out. You want to explain our thinking on that, Sax, and why we're reversing
it? Yeah. Okay. So a few weeks ago on the pod, there was an oblique reference between me and Chamath regarding Solana. And so some internet theorists claim that we were trying to engineer a pump and dump in Solana, which if you actually listen to what we said, it certainly is not a pump. Let me explain what it was. So Kraft is the beneficiary because we're the first investors in Multicoin. We were kind of like their seed investor, we put in something like 40% of the money for their special opportunity fund. They were one of the first investors in Solana. So we are the beneficiary of about $1 billion of Solana. So thank you, Multicoin. At some point, so they have started doing distributions, but at the time I texted Chamath, they hadn't really started doing distributions. I didn't know how deep and liquid the market for Solana was. I just asked Chamath, I'd heard that Chamath may have said something that he was long Solana and wanted to accumulate. So I sent him a text saying, hey, are you interested? You know, I thought maybe we could do an OTC transaction at some point when we get our Solana. He basically, you know, we had a brief exchange about that. And then he mentioned on the pod, that was the extent of it. What I didn't know at the time, but learned subsequently, is that the market for Solana is very deep. About $3.5 billion notional is traded every day. So there's no need, even if we wanted to fully get out of our Solana position, which by the way, we don't even have, you know, Multicoin still has most of it. It's not necessary to do an OTC transaction. We could just sell it.
Explain what OTC transaction is.
Oh, it just means over the counter. It just means that instead of going to an exchange, you would deal with like a trading desk, or it could just be direct, like for me to Chamath. So that was basically the exchange. Chamath and I talked about it for maybe 2 minutes, and then it came up on the pod for 20 seconds. So then some internet theorist basically clipped it and tried to accuse us of organizing a pump and dump. Well, obviously, if you're talking about selling something, it's not a pump. It's also not a dump either. So anyway, the reason why we said cut it out last week is because we didn't want to give oxygen to this stupid conspiracy theory that somebody had invented on the internet with no basis whatsoever, because you could spend all day trying to shoot this stuff down. But then at the Solana conference, enough people told me that this was becoming a meme that I thought was worth addressing. And what you have to understand with crypto is that for every cryptocurrency like Solana, there are haters because they're invested in
it's
Ethereum
very tribal
or Cardano.
Everybody's talking
whatever.
Up their books. There are pump and dumps, and there are armies of anonymous Twitter accounts that will coordinate attacks and or memes, et cetera.
Right. So they're trying to spread the rumor that VCs are big holders in Solana and are going to dump it. The reality is that Multicoin has a large position, but they have LPs. They are slowly distributing their positions to LPs.
Of the tokens. They're not selling them and giving you cash. They're giving you the tokens. You get to decide what you do.
Yes. And by the way, that's what we'd like to do as well. We're currently working through those mechanics because it's actually complicated for a VC firm to distribute in kind through tokens, but
if you had to give them to your LPs subsequently,
that's what I would like to do. Exactly.
Well, actually, so people are doing that with Coinbase. So Coinbase is providing that as a service now, from my understanding.
Right. So we have to work through with our LPs, but that's what we're going to try to do, is distribute it in kind so everyone can make their own decision.
I have a couple things to say. So I've only been a buyer. I haven't sold a single Solana token. And so we are, net buyers, and we're buying a bunch of stuff, but I hate acknowledging that. And this is why, my tone was more non-committal when we did the pod, is that I really don't like this culture that's emerged via Twitter mostly, where you all of a sudden have to be this maximalist that basically falls on their sword and never sells in order to be legitimate. And I think that that's a really dangerous place to be. So, look, if I take a
dangerous?
Yeah. Well, if I take a much, much bigger step back, let me put Solana in the context of crypto, and let me put crypto in the context of the markets and where we are today at the end of the week after, you know, Q3 earnings in November of 2021. We have the stock market at absolute all-time highs.
Ripping.
We have crypto at absolute all-time highs.
Ripping.
We have the art markets. I don't know if you guys saw Phillips and Christie's and Sotheby's this past week at absolute all-time highs.
Sold another Beeple for $25 million.
We have inflation at a 30-year high. We have 10-year break-evens at a 25-year high. We have, you know, $1 point some odd trillion that we just approved last week, and we're still horse trading on another $1.8 trillion of stimulus that we're going to put in. And so when you, and then you have, I think the most important thing, which is the two most important founders of our generation, the two smartest people who have really consistently won, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, have collectively sold more than $11 billion of their holdings this year alone. And if you can't take all of that and decide for yourself what's right for you and your family, you're doing yourself a disservice. I think it's important for me to never sort of like, you know, be forced to tell folks whether I'm buying or selling, although I'm willing to do it in moments where I think it's important. But I think it's really important to understand the context. And so I think like these folks that like think derisively about individuals who are managing risk, I think it's really naive. And I think it's, it creates a lot of missed opportunity for them as well. If the smartest people in the world are now selling their core holdings that they told you they would never sell, and you are not reconsidering your position on things, you're either much smarter than them or you're being really, really reckless.
All right, there you have it. Yeah, and I, you know, just so people also know, inside baseball, we have a docket of stories that we talk about on our group chat that make up the docket for the show, but I'll bring stuff up. And I didn't bring that up in some way to cause trouble or anything. I thought you guys would want to clear the air about it. And I understand Chamath's position of, hey, you don't want to give these things oxygen or whatever, but I think Sachs
I didn't even know that we needed to clear the air until, you know, I went to the conference and enough people mentioned it. So, well,
but what's so funny is half the people on Twitter spend all their time in crypto land saying things like never going to make it, have fun staying poor. They're extremely, Jason, as you said, tribal. I'm not sure that they're doing first principles analysis of these things.
They're
toxic. They've gotten exceptionally lucky.
Yeah.
Some of them are exceptionally good, but many people, broadly speaking, have gotten exceptionally lucky. And I think a little bit of it is getting to their head where they become, you know, very virulent against people that they think, you know, whose perspectives may actually be negatively affecting their position without actually understanding what David said, which is these are incredibly deep liquid markets and one person's opinion is can't do much of anything.
Right. I mean, that's a really good point. I mean, I'd like to give my opinion on Solana, but the thing, or just crypto in general, the thing that's like hard about it is that it's hard to talk about the benefits of, say, the Solana blockchain without being seen as a pumper of SOL or a dumper of ETH or whatever, because all these things are so intrinsically connected. I mean, I learned a lot of really bullish things about Solana, you know, at this conference. I mean, the biggest thing is, I mean, there's basically a battle for the hearts and minds of developers going on right now between Solana and Ethereum. That's why Solana has raced up to, you know, over 200. It's, I don't know what, like 7,000% increase or something incredible like that. The reason is because Solana as a blockchain gives confirmations back in something like 400 milliseconds, whereas Ethereum takes, you know, minutes. And, you know, a transaction that might cost tens of dollars, $10, $20, $30, $50 of gas on Ethereum costs pennies on Solana. And so that's the advantage.
Yeah,
exactly. It's also, you know, a lot of developers feel like the tools, the developer tools that they've created are easier than building on Solidity. The thing that Solana gives up, the trade-off that it makes, is decentralization. There's basically that transactions are processed by 20 validators and they're a top 20 based on holdings of SOL. So it's kind of like this proof of stake model. So anyway, there's some trade-offs there. I can tell you that, you know, it's the view of, you know, our friends at Multicoin. And, you know, I heard a lot of this views at the conference, although obviously you have to take it with a grain of salt because these are the biggest believers, but their view is that Solana over the next year will flip Ethereum based on developer activity, that there's real companies being created.
We spend a lot of time actually before we do anything, is that's the only thing we've been looking at, you know, and Syndica, Fractal, a lot of the stuff that we've done, DSO, is purely driven by developer interest. When we see developers in the open source ecosystem, building things on top of this stuff, making stuff that's composable and usable by other people and building infrastructure, you know, we don't really second guess that because they are spending their the most important currency, which is not monetary capital, but human capital.
Yeah, their right? time, There's their skill.
The time and their skill and
they
their reputation.
They can apply to another project. Yeah.
And so when enough developers, so I've always thought you just follow the developers and as more and more projects get started, you just have to unemotionally support that. I think the writing is on the wall, which is Bitcoin is gold. Ethereum looks like it's trending to be silver. And Solana could be the first, but there will be others that come after it. Of real developer ecosystems that can be built on top of it. The other thing that I would offer up to people for them to think about is before you blindly go and rush into crypto, one way in which I try to think about these things is in the following way. You see these projects get started all the time, and I would view each of these projects as a mini economy and really try to think what is the economic value of what's happening under the hood. So simple example, you know, Helium is an interesting project that's trying to build a completely decentralized, you know, 5G infrastructure, right? Render is a really interesting project that's trying to build a completely decentralized, you know, graphical processing infrastructure, right? GPUs, essentially. In both of those things, you can quantifiably, economically measure what the value is that people get, right? In the case of Render, you're basically displacing an AWS instance. And so, that has a price and a value. And so, you know, for Render to be valuable, there's an economic value that it replaces. If you're joining a hotspot that has an economic value where you necessarily have to pay, you know, to get internet connectivity, if you all of a sudden are on the Helium network, that displaces a measurable economic quantum. Understanding that is probably, and taking the absolute value of that is the best way of really understanding which projects have potential. So if you take those two ideas and marry them together, where is their developer interest and where is their measurable economic activity? At the intersection of those, I think are the really compelling projects that can win.
Well, and the thing that complicates all of this is that the developers are not just picking based on which language or technology or stack they think has the most potential. They also have acquired economic stakes in it. So a developer who might be objective and say, hey, this new platform is better than Ethereum, might be sitting on millions of dollars in Ethereum and they're like, I want to keep my bet going here, and I'm going to keep talking my book.
Possibly, but I do think that developers in general will choose the platform that's easiest and cheapest and fastest for them to develop on.
Which would mean the list on CoinMarketCap of market cap ones that has been static for a decade of crypto almost, you know, or largely the top 10 doesn't change that much. It's XRP, it's Stellar, Ethereum, Bitcoin, Tether, that could be up for grabs. That whole thing could change now that people are actually building projects and the projects are getting competitive with each other. And that's that flippening we're talking about, correct, Sax?
Yeah, I think that what's tricky here, again, is I never want to give anyone investment advice. I mean, sure. That's just not my job. And if there's anyone out there listening to the show because they're trying to get like tips or tricks, whatever, for investment, like I'm not really comfortable telling people what to do.
Sure.
So, you know, everyone just has to understand that. I do feel like what I saw at this conference over the past week in terms of developer enthusiasm and activity was very bullish. Actually, it was a lot like I went to the Ethereum conference, I think it was back in 2017, several years ago, and it felt a little bit like that. Although I would say that this time it felt less academic. Like several years ago, it felt more like white papers. Now it actually feels like real projects and businesses that people are trying to create.
Still so, infrastructure and less applications or more applications
well, Chamath, and infrastructure? Chamath mentioned a couple of them. So there's Helium, which is creating a decentralized network for Wi-Fi. There's Render, which is creating a decentralized network for GPU. There's one called HiveMapper, where I met the founder. It's a decentralized network for people to map the world. You can think of, you know, the concept of a miner that Bitcoin invented. Think of them more as like a resource provider to a network. So with Bitcoin, you know, we call them miners, but they're the validators of transactions, and we're trying to incentivize them through block rewards, basically through small bits of Bitcoin that get released to provide these valuable computing resources to the network. And so people are figuring out now how to create massively decentralized networks where you have, you know, thousands or millions of resource providers provide a little bit of something to the network for everyone's benefit, and in exchange they get some coin. That's like a really interesting model that couldn't exist before crypto. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting. But, you know, in order for that to work, you have to have like very, you need fast, efficient, scalable blockchains. And the feeling as, I mean, I'll give credit here to Tushar, who's one of the GPs of Multicoin. His view is that this was the iPhone moment for blockchain, that what Solana has built, because it's massively scalable and also very cheap. I mean, again, you can run a lot of transactions for pennies. Now, all of that is obviously very bullish for Solana. The thing I wrestle with is, and Chamath kind of alluded to this, is I think everything's kind of in a bubble right now because of monetary and fiscal policy. And so, you know, I guess you could say that I'm long Solana versus ETH, but I do kind of worry that the whole world right now is very bubbly. And so as a GP, like, what do you do about that? I can tell you right now, like this second, we are sitting on Solana that we have not sold. So, you know, I am long in that sense. However, sometime over the next whatever number of years, we will distribute out our position of Solana to LPs.
And then the LPs will make their decisions.
And then they'll make their decisions.
Some LPs might specialize in crypto and want to keep it. Other ones might not want to hold assets and need that money to fund their endowment, to give scholarships to students, or whatever your LPs particularly do. Well, yeah, I mean, and so I guess to the issue of, hey, we're not giving investment advice here, we are all capital allocators and startup creators. So we're talking about our day-to-day lives here. Nobody should interpret this as investment advice, and especially not in a world now. I don't know if you guys saw what happened with Rivian this week. I don't know how we don't talk about a company with essentially no public sales. They've sold 148 cars to their employees. It's worth $120 billion. Any, Freeberg, did you see this IPO? Any thoughts on it?
Seems like a high.
Do you have investment advice for the audience that you'd like to give? Tell me what Rivian does.
Wait, can you play that video that you found that you shared with everyone? You have that video queued up?
Okay, well, we do have it. We could queue it up. Did you see this yet, Sax?
Who is this guy?
No, I haven't. Oh, that. Yeah. Well, but just, so I don't want to beat this point to death, but I just think it's so important for the audience that what they should be getting out of the show, if they're fans, is maybe like advice on how to think.
Yeah, or critical thinking.
Exactly, critical thinking, right. And critical, like, how thinking. We think about investments.
First principles.
Tips. Exactly. So look, if you want to invest in crypto, first of all, like, go understand like what all these different projects or blockchains do and figure out what is the purpose of the token in that system. What are the token economics?
What's the utility?
Does it even make sense, or is it just a scam? Then if it's something like a blockchain, go research how many projects have developers on them and how much code is being checked in.
And maybe open a wallet and buy some NFTs and buy some ETH and transfer it and learn just how to set up your internet connection.
Right.
You know, exactly. This was 1995.
Right, exactly. And then on top of all that, you got to consider macro forces because, I mean, and I think, you know, my friends at Multicoin would fully concede this, that, you know, it could be the case that if there's a crypto bust over the next year, and this thing, you know, crypto has gone through boom and bust cycles for many, many years.
That is the standard.
It's the standard. So you could have a situation in which, for example, Solana flips ETH and yet still goes down in value because there's an overall bust cycle. So, you know, you have to consider the macroeconomic factors as well. So there's a lot of things to consider here. And then you also have to consider your own risk tolerance and, you know, what is appropriate for your portfolio. And it may be different.
When do you need your money? Are you a 25-year-old?
Everything is at all-time highs and the two smartest men in the world are selling.
not just them, by the way. There are other guys that are heavily on the other side waiting for this whole thing to go. Like Druckenmiller has been very vocal about this. And he's been the best macro trader in the last 30 years. So,
his position is what exactly?
That we're printing too much money and we're in a lot of trouble. So, you know, look, I mean, generally there is, I think a good point of view being shared here, which is, you know, understanding how to think about what you're investing in and what your expectations are versus relying on someone's advice or opinion on what to do. If you have to rely on someone else's advice or opinion on what to do, you're going to eventually lose money.
You should not be in that investment category.
You should not be in the market. Because guess what? Anyone that's giving you advice or opinions is going to make money if you do what they tell you to do. If you do what they tell you to do. End of story. So at some point, they're going to all make money and you're going to end up losing money. And it's a better game to play. To learn how to kind of be thoughtful about where's your money going, what are you investing in? And it takes a lot of time and a lot of money. I've been sitting here silently as you guys have been talking deeply about Solana and Ethereum and Bitcoin and the crypto markets, because I realized so much of you know, what's needed to be successful in entering this market is a depth of understanding and a depth of knowledge. My time is highly limited. I have spent no time on understanding crypto markets because it's so deep and it's so fluid. It's changing every day. It's changing every week. So if I can't get smart enough to feel confident about the opinions and decisions that I would be making as an investor, I decide not to invest and I stay out. And so I'm not an active crypto investor.
And you're a specialist. And you're on the razor's edge on synthetic biology and so many other
whatever
categories.
It is. There are other areas where it's better for me to spend my time and my energy. Yes. And I've chosen to do that versus being drawn into what feels like a very exciting kind of, you know, turbulent time. There are other areas that I kind of spend my time on. And I just kind of try to recognize that maybe I don't know what I'm doing if I were to try and get involved here. And so I'd rather stay out. And I think that's counsel for anyone. You know, if you're going to make an investment, it's important to feel confident about the knowledge and the depth needed to kind of be different than the rest of the market.
I'll build on your point. Like when I started doing my SPACs, I started to write these one pagers, and those one pagers were artifacts for me to hold myself accountable for how I saw something in a moment in time, and then to be able to see whether it was tracking to that, and then also to share it to other people, a starting point, as David said, a journey where they should then, if they're curious, go and do their own work. It turned out not enough people were doing the work. So then I had to start adding disclaimers to these things saying, hey guys, I'm not telling you to buy this. Please be abundantly clear. These next SPACs that I will eventually launch, you're going to see an entire like in red block letters, like, please don't buy this.
Right.
Because to your point, it doesn't matter what you say. People want a lazy, easy way out. And so I just want to reiterate what all of you guys said. None of us are dispensing advice. We are not telling you to do anything. Please do your own work and please come to your own conclusion.
Period.
It is your responsibility. And if you're not sure, go and look at your children in the face or your significant other in the face. You are responsible to them. And so do your own work.
I'll say one more point on where I sit as an investor. I choose to only participate in investing in what I call productive assets. That is, you put some money into something and whatever that thing is generating money in some way or is trying to generate value through a set of activities, like a business. Or owning an apartment building where you're making rent, you know, anything that, or, you know, a group of people that are trying to have some breakthrough or some discovery, those are productive assets. There's a lot of what's going on now that is what I would call speculative assets, which is the only way you make money is if someone else pays more in the future versus what you're paying. And there isn't an underlying productive asset to what you're putting money into.
Art, you're describing every ICO or shitcoin,
every ICO, every NFT, and the art market, right? These are examples of unproductive assets. They're speculative assets in the sense that you're speculating that at some point the price of them are going to go up, and somebody
wants that NFT more than you.
Someone down the road will pay more for that asset than what you paid, but that underlying asset, that capital that you just put in, didn't go in to build something.
It basically IP.
It went into someone else's pocket that sold that asset to you. And you're eventually going to try and sell it to someone else. And so, you know, there's a real attraction here because what we just talked about is really hard to do. Having fundamental analysis and understanding of businesses and a fundamental understanding of what's working and what's not and when to shift. And oh my gosh, you know, are things different or are they not? To do that is really hard. So people end up relying on opinions of others or they end up running into speculative markets. And the speculative markets are easy to understand. Someone just paid more for X than the other person did. Therefore, there's a trend line. It's going up. It's like playing roulette and, you know, black keeps coming up and you're like, okay, it's going to be black again.
It has to be black. There were seven, correct?
There were seven blacks. And so I think that that's a really important kind of takeaway for folks that might be new as investors.
We're all susceptible. We're all susceptible to this. Like I was just looking, you know, at my own performance coming into the end of this year. And, you know, I did a lot of SPACs this year, but I also did these pipes, which are these third-party deals.
Private investment in public entities.
Exactly. Other people's deals that they were bringing to the market where they said, Chamath, do you want to be a part of it? And, you know, and I did. And part of it was I was looking at these things and, you know, Freeberg doing my work. But in the end, it turned out I didn't do nearly as much as I probably should have because I ended up sitting on top of other people's work versus the original or underwriting that I would do if it was my own deal itself, right? Anyways, the net of it all is like, you know, that was very inefficient capital deployment. And as I look at it now, it's like, you know, I'm down, well, I'm technically up 19%, but that's really because of one deal. If I take that one deal out, which was a total outlier, I'm down 17% on about $200 million of investment.
When you were a fast follower, not the originator, it wasn't your idea. This is critically important. There are many different ways to make money, but you have to specialize and you have to have first principles and your knowledge.
I trusted other people. I did the same thing that I'm saying to other people not to do. Do not just copy other people. You have to do your own principal work. And even when you do your own principal work, it may not be enough. And you have to be willing to basically see the forest from the trees and walk away. And so all these pipes, I'm in the midst of sort of cleaning up and selling down. And they've been just a kind of a disaster for me.
I want to build on this for a second, because I think it's critically important what you said as well, Friedberg. You have to be comfortable with the investment you're making. I look at these companies and I look at the underlying customer, the product, you know, and what kind of revenue it's going to generate. And people thought I was dunking on Rivian yesterday. And I said, listen, you know, when Tesla went public, people forget their valuation was $1.5
billion. 1.7.
Okay. So $1.7 billion when they went public. Now, they already had thousands of roadsters and they had already had the
$93 million of revenue in year one.
So this was dramatically different than what Rivian had. Rivian is being valued at, you know, whatever that is, $120 billion, I think, yesterday. Rivian has $17 billion in cash. Somebody asked me at the poker game last night what I value Rivian at. I said $17 million in cash plus $3 billion, double roughly what Tesla's was. The market's hotter right now, whatever. But I put them at $20 billion and people were giving me a hard time about it. I said, I think that's actually the realistic valuation for this company. And we are in a very dangerous moment in time right now where I think people are, whether it's meme stocks or crypto or NFTs, suspending disbelief, in some cases SPACs, because they're not all created equal. And certainly in private companies, we're seeing this, where people are giving people an amount of credit which makes no logical sense and is getting further and further disconnected from reality. So as an investor, you have a choice. Either you have your fundamentals, which I'm not going to change my fundamentals. I'm going to focus on the fundamentals that got me where I am, and I'm not going to be involved in a $100 billion market cap company that hasn't launched a product yet, let alone a $120 billion one. I'll stay focused on startups. Yeah.
But what you're saying is also important, because you're highlighting how you value that company. You individually said, I think that company's worth some multiple of how many cars have been sold in the past. Elon sold, you know, thousands of cars. He was worth $1.7 billion. These guys have sold. And other people are coming in and looking at this company and saying they've built facilities, they've built assembly lines, and they've got pre-orders and bookings for lots and lots of cars down in the future. And clearly they've gone in and, you know, some people have gone in and seen these plants and seen these cars actually working. So, you know, it's really important to take note that your point of view is one point of view in a very diverse market with many points of view. And everyone's going to come into this market. And that's why, unless you individually as an investor have a strong point of view and can show that you can apply your unique insights to consistently beat the market making decisions, investment decisions like that, you're eventually going to lose, because those other points of view will be a bigger view of the truth and you'll lose money. And that's why, that's why picking stocks is ultimately a loser's game unless you have some unique ability and insight. For most people, historically, and in an up market,
You need to have an edge. And in the public markets are hard to say that.
There's some unique competency that you need
because
to bring to the table.
I mean, if we double click on what you just said as the things that would be reasons to bet on Rivian, number one, they have 48,000 orders of pickup trucks against the F-150, which is now electric from Ford, and a million
Why you're arguing this, right? Like, you're just making a point that we don't have someone on the panel right now, but someone else could come in and argue.
Okay, go ahead,
Chamath. And I would just say, this is the part of the conversation, to be honest, Jason, to give you feedback, I don't like, because Rivian, just in defense of Rivian for a second, what I have heard is that it's a well-engineered car, or truck rather. They've done a very smart path to market, which is essentially to, you know, build these delivery trucks for Amazon that allowed them to even, frankly, you know, be default alive.
Sure.
Versus, you know, to use the Paul Graham term, instead of default dead. I think the point that's more important here is that it doesn't affect you. So let Rivian do well, you know? And this is part of the cycle.
You're saying I shouldn't have an opinion publicly?
No. I'm just saying this is the part of the cycle that I don't understand, where people legitimately have these zero-sum points of view about companies, And this is where I think Freeburg is more right than anybody else, which is there are, the market is the sum of all these collective points of view.
Sure.
And I think it's fine to it's fine to have one. I think it's a little superficial, your point of view, because it's not really, you know, sitting on top of a model or anything else. And I think it's the same kind of superficiality that the Tesla Q guys had about Tesla for many years as well. It takes a long time. As somebody that does this every day, and I just want to point this out, it takes an enormous amount of time, an enormous amount of work to be 55% right.
I've invested in 350 companies. I meet with 2,000 companies
markets,
a year.
Jason, it's different in the public markets.
My companies are going public now, so I take exception to what you're saying. I know a fraud when I see it. I've seen them before.
Oh, that's a really big statement.
I'm not saying Rivian's at a fraud level yet.
That's not a fraud.
No, but the distance between the valuation and reality is in the $50 to $100 billion range.
I know, but that's not in control of Rivian. That's not in their control. Okay, that's in a bunch of external market participants' control. So you can't pin that on them. My point
what
is,
I would pin it on is the market right now seems dysfunctional and it's not properly measuring.
I know, but
things.
Throwing shade you should throw shade at T. Rowe, Fidelity, all these people that are bidding up your companies, by the way, because they are the ones that are taking Rivian to $120 billion. It's not Rivian's fault.
And Jason, what's really going on in the market?
I think it was public speculators.
No, what's really going on? It's not. You can't sell $16 billion of in an IPO to speculators.
These are at a much lower price.
But these are institutionally placed trade orders. But regardless, the market is clearly right now in productive assets, businesses. The market is looking at a time horizon that it has never looked at before, which is making bets that are 10, 15, 20 years in the future. And that's because of the condition that we're in right now from a monetary policy point of view. Interest rates are so low, there's nowhere to get yield in other assets. So you have to look further and further out to find value.
I accept that.
The market is betting, is making 10-year bets, which is like a VC type
it's
bet.
It's more than a 10-year bet.
Yeah. And Jason, sorry, can I just finish my last point before you interrupt me? My issue, Jason, is I think you are an exceptional angel investor, but just the same way you derided a bunch of late stage guys. Remember last night at poker when we were talking about late stage folks entering into the angel market and the Series A, you were extremely dismissive because you know what the job is to be done to do that job well, and they have a different skill set. Similarly, what I would just offer for you to think about is the people that really underwrite public market stocks well do things and have a skill set that is extremely specific, and it is well trained as well. And I think that.
I accept that.
Let me jump into Jake's defense.
You want to defend me, that's the people are in shock right now. So I'm let you speak. Way to get yourself back in the game.
The sky is purple. The sky is purple. The moon is set.
Yeah.
Breaking news.
Yeah. Hell is freezing over right now.
Hell is freezing over.
Okay. So here's where I think Jake Hall's right. I don't know anything about this Rivian company, but where I think Jake Hall's right is we've seen over and over again that when a startup gets $1 billion plus valuation without a product, invariably ends up somewhere between a disappointment and outright fraud.
Jason's law.
Whether, you know, it was Theranos or Magic Leap or Quibi or whatever. I'm not saying they're all frauds. I mean, I think just Theranos
train
was,
but frauds,
train wrecks, frauds, whatever. So I think it's reasonable for any, let's say, seed or early venture investor to develop the heuristic that I'm not going to invest in anything with $1 billion, with basically unicorn valuation, without seeing the product first. Because we've learned, we've got our hands burnt so many times from these overhyped companies. And here's where I agree. If I can't see and use the product, I'm not investing. I'll invest in a seed stage, but I will not invest in a unicorn stage. No way.
I agree with that. But what I'm saying is when a company is going public like that, there is demonstrable proof of concept there. Okay. The only market in which that's not true is in biotechnology.
Well, I would say for Fisker and Nikola, two related companies, those ones seem very, very shaky.
You can debate about the scalability of these things and you can debate that people didn't do the diligence, but they had to at least put a proof of concept out there for you to judge. If people don't do the work, I agree with you. Like if you're rolling Nikola a truck down a hill, sure.
Outright fraud.
No, but my point is, if you were there and you did your work, you would have seen what you needed to see. What I have heard from people who were investors in both Lucid and Rivian is that they have sat in the cars, they've driven the cars, they've spent time with them, they've seen the factories, and it's very much real. Now what they're debating is ramp and velocity and scale. I don't know. I don't have a position in either.
Neither do I.
I have the bigger macro point of view, which is important to me, which is it's just because these things are in the public markets, I think people think it's easy to judge. And I think actually modeling them and making good decisions is just as hard as it is for private companies.
We need to roll this clip because there is somebody who is giving exceptional advice on CNBC. Let's roll the clip.
Yeah. So, well, Upstart's up about 25% just in 4 days since we bought it. We bought it on about 4 days ago. So that's actually made a nice little move in the short term, probably a little extended right now, but longer term, that's a good looking name. Very powerful, very strong earnings. These stocks are.
What do they do?
Really
I don't
well.
Even know them. What do they do?
Excuse me?
What does Upstart do?
Well. I'm sorry.
What kind of company is it?
Yeah, I'm not. You're breaking up.
Oh. Well, I guess we've got an audio problem with Mark.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Fucking God.
Brutal.
Who is this guy? Who is he?
I have no idea.
J-Cal, is that like your uncle or something? Who is that guy?
Listen.
Yeah.
I mean, just
can
to the point.
Get on CNBC?
Well, you know, the guy's been on many times.
Doesn't this prove what we were saying, which is that you've got to do your own principal work here?
That is why we wanted to play.
Here's a talking head who's probably getting paid for selling some books and giving advice, who knows nothing about what he's telling you.
You can join his membership club for $1,000 a month.
Yeah, I'm sure he's publishing lots of papers that show that he's a highly successful, profitable investor, and look how smart he is. He doesn't even know the company he just promoted on CNBC. It's incredible.
On a mechanical basis here, Chamath, you and I have been on CNBC many times. In that moment... what is going on? What do you think is going on in the host's mind and the producer who has to dump this call? Because they're watching
on.
This.
Let's move on.
The breakdown when he says, I'm sorry.
I have no idea.
What do they do?
I think the point's been made.
Oh, my Lord.
Everybody should do their own work.
Yeah.
Do All your right, let's keep work. Going. Zach, you look like you want to say something.
I mean, it just shows the agenda. Yeah, look, I mean, there is a massive agenda in corporate journalism. There's an agenda by the people Whoa. On these shows to promote Whoa. Positions. There's an agenda by the reporters themselves, and on and on and on it goes. So to Jamal's point, if you just take
Trust
them at
no
face
one.
Value you're, and you don't do your own work, then you're buying into someone else's agenda.
Trust yourself. Okay. One thing that we are trying to all understand is inflation. The CPI has gone up 6.2% in October, the highest jump in 31 years since 1990, according to the Wall Street Journal, fifth straight month of inflation above 5%. You know, somebody tweeted out, we'll pull it up here, Denver Bitcoin put out a year-over-year commodity chart. We can throw up on the screen. And then I think... Friedberg, you shared in the chat the average weekly retail prices around fertilizer. What are our thoughts on the nature of inflation and how that affects our investment?
I think it's decisions? Persistent.
Persistent.
The reason I think it's persistent is that there's all of these things are intertwined. And so, you know, if you want to just bear with me for a second, like when this, let's just go to the entry-level economic job, right? So you're a barista at Starbucks or you work at McDonald's and you're making $17 to $20 an hour. What that does is it shifts labor. And eventually there are other people that are entering the workforce or, you know, may shift jobs. And essentially it just causes this leaky bucket effect where everybody else has to then accommodate itself. So, you know, you have a guy like, you have a company like Amazon, which is now going to pay $25 or $30 to keep folks. Right? Because otherwise they may say, you know, if I make $15 or $16 an hour, I'd rather work at McDonald's. It's simpler.
And free college.
It's not backbreaking work, blah, blah, blah. So then they start to increase the amount that they pay. They increase their benefits and the like. I saw this thing this week. There's a crazy thing that's happening though, which is it's now pulling people from non-traditional job classes into those jobs. There are teachers that are leaving teaching to go work at an Amazon warehouse. There are firefighters that are quitting being a firefighter to go work at an Amazon warehouse because you make the same or more, plus you have all of these other benefits and the job is structurally a lot easier. And so people are making different optimizations. And to that point, I think we talked about this, and Nick, you can put it in the group chat. In Reddit, as an example, there is more engagement in the subreddit around having a simple work life than there is now in Wall Street bets, right? So there's been a structural cultural change where people need to get paid more to do the same amount of work. And then at the same time, you have all of the supply side getting more expensive. Fertilizer makes corn more expensive. Lumber makes house prices more expensive. Chip prices makes the iPhone and cars more expensive or completely backlogged. You know, yesterday at Poker, Sonny was showing us he bought a Tesla and the delivery period is October of 2022.
Yeah,
it's crazy. It's freaking crazy. So I think that this is the beginning of a persistence cycle.
I think those are all like really valid points. The thing I'm seeing now is I think we've moved into what I'll call a contagion phase of inflation, which is people are hearing about inflation. They're seeing it in some places. My gas went up a little bit. My milk went up a little bit, whatever. And they're saying, well, I guess if everybody's raising prices, I need to raise the prices as well of whatever I provide in the world. So I can just keep up with everybody else. And they're not looking at their inputs necessarily and saying, I need to charge more, or that's the best business decision. They're just saying, everything's going up around me. And so they raise prices. I've literally had this happen 3 or 4 times. And I went to buy a car and they wanted $15K over sticker. And I didn't buy it based on principle, but I'm sitting here going like, maybe I'm an idiot. Maybe I should just pay the $15K over sticker. What are your thoughts, Sax, on inflation and the contagion?
My thoughts are, I told you guys like 6 months ago about this.
Yeah.
Can we just replay what I said on episode 32?
It's got his researchers in the background giving.
Written down what you said on a per episode. Absolutely. Basis?
No, this guy's in the fucking debate club. Stanford debate club over
Some
here.
Some of us, when we make predictions, take them seriously. So, you know.
Oh, was that a dig at Professor Ice Cold Takes?
I'll give you guys a link to a prediction that was made.
I just want to replay the 20 seconds in May.
Here we go. The two Davids dueling again, just like in the group chat.
No, I'm not dueling.
Right, here's Friedberg. January 1st, 2021. If you don't think inflation is already here, you missed what happened to the stock market. Companies aren't performing better. We're just inflating everything. Financial assets first. Everything else will follow.
That was a good one.
Sax, just make your point. Just make your point.
Just add the clip. I'm beginning to wonder if Biden's going to be a Jimmy Carter here, because frankly, all he had to do was leave things well enough alone. COVID was winding down. We had a vaccine. All they had to do was distribute it to as many people as possible. End COVID, let the recovery take shape. And instead, they pushed this insane $10 trillion agenda. This is going to backfire massively. Look, if the economy turns, we were set for a post-COVID boom. And right now, that is all at risk because, Jamath, like you're saying, they're keeping the economy closed or parts of it way too long. They then overcompensate for that by printing a ton of money, and then they overcompensate for that by raising taxes too much.
Just to build on that, so that second step of their overcompensating, their inability to open with money is so true, because then what happens is your labor force stays impaired because people make enough money by not working.
It was true when I said it in May. It's even more true now.
He said there was inflation. Okay, so there was inflation. Okay, so now, great, good job.
Somebody made a prediction that was proven true.
Yeah, I made one in January that said the same thing. Now, look, you can do three things to curb inflation. Raise rates, right? When you raise interest rates, you slow spending. Prices come down, inflation slows. But the issue when you raise rates is obviously you see things like job loss and economic growth declines, and it can very quickly spiral the other way. This is the big challenge of Fed tapering. The other option, as we've seen a significant attempt at lately, is to raise revenue, right? So increase tax rates, tax a broader swath of people at a higher rate or a broader swath of business at a higher rate. So it's very likely that, you know, tax revenue could kind of present itself again as a driver if inflation continues to spiral up. And the third, which is the least likely, is cut spending, right? The federal government spending the way it does right now makes a very inefficient way of kind of putting capital into the system and inflating. We've seen historically that anything that the federal government spends money on, like healthcare and education, the costs very quickly spiral out of control. Super inefficient. Why not just give that money to the free market to make decisions on how to spend it? It would be more efficient, et cetera. And the market would effectively find balance where buyers and sellers are equivalent, as opposed to having the federal government driving the price of everything up. The fourth option that people don't talk about, which I think may end up becoming an important option, not kind of oblique option, but more kind of backdrop, is to start a war. And, you know, when you start a war...
Wag the dog.
Yeah, when you start a war, you stimulate the economy without needing to pump additional capital in, so you can increase growth and avoid the risk of stagflation. and you can source resources that otherwise wouldn't be kind of flowing in the trade, or basically in a land grab type situation. But it doesn't necessarily mean that policymakers would say, hey, let's go start a war to decrease inflation.
Taiwan.
But the premise that conflict can improve the economy is a important backdrop that starts to play into policy decisions that might get made over the next couple of months and quarters. And that's really important. Whether or not the posturing is one of partnership and reducing the tension with foreign nations or one of increasing the tension, it's more likely that we would want to increase the tension when we're in an inflationary environment. So
that's quite a conspiracy there. So what do you think, Sax?
Okay, we got to go back to first principles on this thing. We're not going to start a war to tame inflation, okay? But let me just explain what inflation is, because I'm not sure people like fully understand like how this works. Inflation is very simple. It's too much money chasing too few goods, okay? And we have both sides of the equation going on right now. On the supply side, on the good side, we've got shortages. We've got the ports backed up. We've got paying people not to work. We still have the $2 trillion of COVID relief passed earlier this year, which was responding to a problem that was largely winding down. So we have these labor shortages. We have people dropping out of the workforce in record numbers. In the number that just came out showed we had more people quitting their jobs than ever before. So we have a shortage in terms of the production of goods and services that people want. At the same time, we have this monetary and fiscal expansion coming out of Washington. You've got, you know, again, they did the $1.9 trillion of COVID relief. They did $1.2 trillion of infrastructure. Biden's still talking about another $2 trillion of social welfare. You have the Fed still printing money with QE. So you've got this massive expansion in the amount of money. So look, too much money chasing too few goods creates this problem. And it was very predictable. And so what I said back in May, this is what I was warning about. And it goes back to the Druckenmiller clip that we were talking about all the way back in May. He said the same thing, that we had a reckless fiscal and monetary expansionary policy coming out of Washington at a time we didn't need it. Because if you looked at like retail spending back in May, it was back to above trend. So, you know, in other words, like there was no demand problem. The economy was back and they've just been pumping and pumping out of Washington.
We had good intent. We wanted to make people not suffer. We wanted to get the economy on tap. We may have just made a bigger bet than we needed to.
We overdid it,
clearly.
But look, who wants to be the politician, quite frankly?
Yeah, it's not going to get you re-elected.
Who ends the eviction moratorium, right?
The gravy train, yeah.
Nobody wants to be the politician who says, okay, now you suddenly have to pay your rent. But yes, Obviously people have to pay their rent.
And we're taking away your bonus unemployment. I mean, people have to go back to work at some point when there's 10 million jobs open. Just as a I've been watching the Taiwan situation like a hawk, and I don't know if you saw this week, to go off on another tangent, but the U.S. is testing Israeli's Iron Dome in Guam as a defense against Chinese cruise missiles, obviously for possible deployment in Taiwan. And I don't know if you're watching Enes Kanter in the NBA, but he has been going on CNN and stuff like that now talking about China. Pretty amazing.
Maybe I predict escalating global conflict. That'll be my prediction to mark the Q4.
Well, I think that's a pretty valid prediction, but I just think it's a little bit separate than inflation.
Like I said, it's not an explicit decision, but I do think that in the backdrop of an inflationary environment where you have something that can temper the condition at home, that at the same time, you know, might sell politically.
But it's not going to solve anything politically. Okay. I mean, World War II, you know, famously got us out of the Great Depression because that did stimulate demand. But in the situation we're in today, we have too much demand. We have retail is trending way above curve. What we have is a supply shortage, and devoting resources, taking them away from the productive economy to go to war would only exacerbate the problem and make it even worse. What we need right now actually is for Washington to back off, to stop pumping demand. With this, you know, now they're still talking about this $2 trillion
machine.
So the money printing, that's what we need. We need them to get out of the way and to stop these disincentives for production and work. So you have, Manchin was exactly right about this. Okay. Do you remember when Manchin, when he was resisting this $2 trillion social welfare bill? I mean, the things he said are already coming true. I mean, he said this months ago. He said that we should take a strategic pause. Because he said, this is a quote, by all accounts, the threat posed by record inflation to the American people is not transitory and is instead getting worse. From the grocery store to the gas pump, Americans know that the inflation tax is real, and DC can no longer ignore the economic pain Americans feel every day. That's what he was saying this past summer, several months ago, and they rolled right over him.
The psychology of this could be self-fulfilling as well, because what's going to happen is you're going to have everybody raise prices because it's now become an escalation. You know, your hairdresser, your, you know, whatever, you know, services you're using, whatever product you're buying, whatever restaurant you're going to is going to put $2 on every appetizer and $5 on every entree. Everything is just going to keep going up. And then what happens is people who are in the middle class or, you know, who are consumers of products in a large way will say, you know what, I'm going to put off buying a car. Then we're going to be driving all this supply up. And then people are going to say, you know what, fuck it, I'll just drive this one for two more years. And right. That's going to cause stagnation. And this
called stagflation. It's what we had in the 1970s. And you're right. It's called an inflationary spiral, which is the future expectations of increasing prices means that people start increasing them now. And that feeds on itself.
Yes.
And that's what we had in the late 1970s. And the thing that broke that was Paul Volcker jacking up interest rates. It was very painful. It caused a very severe recession in the early 1980s. But then the economy came roaring out of that by 83. It got Reagan elected in 84. And you had 30 straight years of declining interest rates, and that led to a stock market boom. So the problem we have now, okay, here's the problem we have, is there's going to be no Paul Volcker. Why? We can't afford to jack up rates because the federal government's debt is so much bigger than it used to be.
And we are not on a fixed rate. We're on a variable rate. All of the debt we take...
The average maturity of government debt right now is 5 years, okay? So, that means the whole debt rolls over within 5 years. So if they jack up interest rates, we have almost $30 trillion of U.S. federal debt right now. So every 1% that they increase interest rates, that means another $300 billion a year of debt service payments.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that means you can't spend it on programs.
Exactly. So there's going to be enormous pressure on the Fed not to raise rates. You already are hearing Biden rattling the saber, saying that Powell may not be his choice for a second term. By the way, Powell is very dovish. He's basically saying we can't raise rates right now because of this and that. So, but Biden administration, nobody in Washington ever wants rates to go up, right? They want to keep these low rates forever. This is the problem is, look, at the end of the day, I don't know what the inflation picture is going to look like next year. But what concerns me is we don't have effective tools to fight it anymore because we've given up our ability to raise rates because it would increase the cost of the debt so much. And I mean, so just one article just to share with you guys. Is this, again, one of my favorite sources of economic information is the Fred blog, which is from
Fred blog's right.
From the St. Louis Fed. Okay.
Super.
They wrote a blog talking about two tales of federal debt. Okay. And the article is about, here's why there's so much disagreement on whether the federal government debt is too high. So the first chart shows debt to GDP. This was always the way of looking at government debt, was simply looking at the ratio of debt to GDP. It's now something like 125% in peacetime. I don't think we've had a higher peacetime ratio. That would tell you things were out of control. But for the last decade, while this has been going on, you had this whole school of thought, the MMT, modern monetary theory, all these economists and experts and politicians in the media were eager to buy in because they want to spend the money. Okay. And what they said is, no, it's not debt to GDP. You should look at debt service to GDP. This is the second chart on that blog. And so debt service to GDP was staying constant or even going down as the debt to GDP was going up. Why? Because interest rates were so low. The problem is, what was so foolish about this point of view is it had assumed that interest rates were going to last forever. Well, if that was your point of view, why didn't you do what Trump actually suggested several years ago when he suggested having 100-year T-bills? They should have locked in much, much longer duration maturities on the federal debt. And instead, and Yellen rejected this, okay? And so you've got a 5-year average duration, which means that if interest rates go back up, the debt service cost is going to explode.
Yeah.
Sure. In 1980, we changed the goalposts for CPI. So even as a measurement to know what we look at, and I think Jack Dorsey tweeted this out. So Nick, you may be able to find this tweet, but you know, we changed the measurement of how CPI measures. And so if you go back to the original measurement, it looks like inflation and CPI is much more pernicious than we would otherwise think it if we just look at the new CPI that we started to look at as of 1980. So that's another sort of like point.
Yeah, we did the same thing with
I just go back to what
we
I said early
who
on.
Had given up looking
the
for
two
jobs,
smartest people that we both know are net sellers.
Well, they're selling some, yeah. I mean, they're not selling everything.
I'm just saying the two smartest people we know.
I mean, we don't want to give financial advice here, but should everybody be moving to cash? No. Where do you put your money?
No, I think I'm totally confused.
This is, I think, the admission.
Just buy productive assets, great businesses that have durability, and let them ride for 20 years.
I like your answer. The fact is, we're all confounded as to what to do at this moment in time. We're all trying to figure this out, and we do this for a living.
But then you're trading the market like everyone else all the time. Like, you know, why trade the market when you can just buy great businesses, own stakes in them, and let it rest?
No, I'm just talking holistically where to put money.
I mean, my practical issue is that I don't have infinite money. And so in order to put my money into productive assets, I have to sell other productive assets.
Well, so, if you've got other productive assets, leave them in. Why sell?
Well, then it's like, then I'm basically, you know, doubling down on a worldview that may be old and dated, right? So if I'm long a bunch of software companies and I really want to do something in climate science or biotech, what am I supposed to do?
Don't try and time the market, shift your assets, right? Why do you care what the
I'm not trying to time the market. I'm just saying if my worldview shifts to really want to double down on climate science or alternative finance or biotech, I have to raise capital to do that.
You have to raise capital is what you're saying.
Right. But for me, I'm not raising it from other people. I'm raising it for myself. So but I have to sell things
like
I already own.
To me, the best place to be right now is in the company formation space, because when you create a company, like Friedberg does every 3 months, there is so much value being created at that moment in time and so much further capital getting poured into it that if you are the originator of the company and you get some big slice of the cap table for doing that, which is completely valid, you originated the company, whether it's Munich or Call-In or whatever it is, man, that is a great moment of creation of wealth creation. And when you're the person putting the money in at the $1 billion valuation before the company, whatever, Call-In, Clubhouse, went from 100 million to 4 billion with no revenue. I don't know what's happening in the world, but pretty crazy. Do we want to go on to Xi Jinping and he's going to be speaking with Biden on Monday.
It's done. He got it done before his video, his Zoom with Biden.
So they're doing it.
He's now the supreme leader.
Xi Jinping hasn't left China.
He's now the supreme leader.
Explain what this means, Chamath, from the story.
I mean, I think the basic takeaway is that they've been working inside the body politic inside of China to basically reflect Xi on the same level as Mao. And effectively, what this means is that it allows him to remain the leader of China indefinitely. And so there is no transition of power. Typically, what had happened was there were these 10-year windows, and you know, you go Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, you know, 10-year cycles, and then they pass the baton. But it now looks like we'll be living with Xi Jinping until you know he joins the afterworld. So he's ruler for life of China, basically. Crazy.
I think that's exactly right.
What an incredible feat of political maneuvering. Without judging it, just to say what a complicated Byzantine political infrastructure he must have had to navigate. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he played this three-dimensional chess with all these people, the slow systematic dismantling of the old guard, placing all of his people in, then slowly moving towards this kind of recognition for him.
You sound a little bit admiring, Chamath.
Yeah, no, the dictator got his name for a reason. Somewhere, Donald Trump and Steve Bannon are like, what did we do wrong? We were so close. January 6th, if Pence would have just played ball, Sachs, you'd still be in power. Huh? Your guys dropped the ball.
And we wouldn't have inflationary.
Just think, if Trump was leader for life.
You know, Jason, given how accurate my predictions have been, you should have a little bit more respect for my political positions.
What do you guys think happens now that Xi basically is ruler for life? You know, I think the Chinese term for it is historic figure, which is their parlance of saying, you know, you're basically
you're a made man, basically. You can't get whacked. Nobody can touch you. You're good for life. The end. Nobody can question you.
I mean, can you imagine Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, and now Xi Jinping? Incredible. Like, he is at that level.
Well, it means if you start a war and a serious military conflict, that nobody can question you, right? You're the supreme leader. So it's sort of like Putin and MBS. Like, MBS can go kill a journalist and he's got nobody to answer to. It means he has nobody to answer to.
Mao Zedong initiated the revolution. And, you know, Deng Xiaoping was really the architect of free markets that has made China the economic powerhouse that it is today. their internal reflection as Xi Jinping is on the same scale of that. Now, I mean, I can't claim to know enough Chinese. But
what is his vision for the future of China?
What is the accomplishment that's going to really put him in that league? And you'd have to say it's the annexation of Taiwan. I mean, that's the thing that he must be looking to do before, you know, his time
to reunify China.
That's the thing that could put him in that league. And so that is the tripwire that, to Freeberg's point, that could lead to, you know, a conflict.
I think they, you know, I hate to say that Freeberg is wrong, because I don't think in this case I can. I do think that there is some left tail risk for like a crazy wag the dog moment in Taiwan. It would be really scary. Really scary.
Right now, if I was looking at the sizes of the navies, people don't know this. Japan actually has a very large defensive navy. The UK and the United States obviously have very large ones. China's is large, but not on a tonnage basis. They have a lot of ships. But together, I don't know if you saw the military exercises going on, but New Zealand, Australia, the United States, UK, and Japan were basically, I think South Korea, were basically driving their ships around the South China Sea. This is going to be, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, I did a really interesting interview with the historian and commentator Neil Ferguson, who is also a pretty avid China watcher. And I did an interview with him actually on my app. You don't want me to say the name.
The app shall not be named.
Yeah. But anyway, so he had a really great line, which is he said that the issue of Taiwan, it's basically like the issue of Cuba and Berlin and the Persian Gulf all rolled into one. So it's like Cuba and the Cuban Missile Crisis because it's right there off the shore of China. It's like Berlin, you know, because that was basically the dividing line between freedom and, you know, totalitarianism, you know, where the Berlin Wall got built. And it's like the Persian Gulf because the new oil are the semiconductors, the chips that are fabbed in Taiwan at TSMC. And so all the resources that we're dependent on for the new economy are all right there. So
super smart framing.
Yeah. I thought it was a clever line.
The thing we have to remember about Xi is that his father was a commander for Mao and was then a vice premier. And so, you know, his historical, he is the original princeling, right? Remember, you know, there's this context of these Chinese princelings, but he is one of these originalists. And so his motivation will be, it seems at least, to bring China back into that spectrum of power, which is really about a consolidated country and a single nation state. And that has to include Taiwan. It can't not. So to your point, David, it's almost more motivation for him to go off on some crazy adventure and try to reclaim it. That's going to be crazy.
It's really interesting to look at the tonnage of ships and the number of ships. The United States has over 6,000 tons of ships, 949, according to globalsecurity.org. China has only 2,000 tons and 1,000 ships. They have a lot of smaller ships. And then Russia, UK, India, Japan, France, Indonesia, Turkey, Germany, Italy.
These are warships, Jason? Or?
Yeah, this is their Navy warships. And so they're fighting. But Japan has a very large one. I wasn't aware of this because I thought they were not doing military buildup, but they have what's called a defensive navy, which can do offensive stuff. So I think this is really problematic.
How many
for China.
Of these ships are smaller than Sachs's yacht that he rented this summer?
Yeah, Sachs's tonnage would kind of put the United States over the top, I think, in this
the
conflict.
The gross tonnage of Sachs's yacht this
Bezos
summer
is going to be donating his new yacht
sure,
to the...
For sure, it's bigger than Indonesia. I see Indonesia on this list. Turkey, I mean, how big could their yachts be?
In my defense, it was a starter yacht.
In my indefensible lifestyle.
Next one will be bigger.
Yeah, Solana is going to make sure of that, right? Yeah, you can buy yachts with Solana. All right, I think we covered enough. GE and Toshiba can't run their businesses, so they're each separating into three separate companies.
Let's talk about that.
That's interesting, actually.
And Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah, we should talk about it
today.
All right, so on Tuesday, GE announced they were splitting into three separate companies, aviation, healthcare, and energy. Toshiba reported a similar plan.
Johnson & Johnson today?
Johnson & Johnson was today. This is in direct conflict with the consolidation and the creation of conglomerates and basically
but not I think this is an important point, J.Cal. You know, in the 80s and 90s, it was cool to create conglomerates, meaning you would kind of stick businesses together that were
RJR,
somewhat disparate because you could financially engineer a way to do it that would juice shareholder returns, right? You could borrow money, add lots of scale, the cost of debt goes down, you could increase your debt load, et cetera. And you know, the challenge is, like, when you're scaling a business, you either need to grow your revenue organically or you need to acquire. And when you're acquiring, you're either acquiring horizontally or you're acquiring vertically, meaning you're kind of integrating your supply chain, or you're integrating, or you're adding ancillary businesses that you can cross-sell. So you're either reducing your costs or increasing your cross-selling ability. So there's some inherent synergy in the acquisition. The problem with conglomerates is there is very little synergy. Meaning, like, when you acquire a new business, like an aviation business, it doesn't create synergy for your healthcare business. And, you know, there was always a rationalization that these managers of these big conglomerates had, which was like, oh, well, we could do this and we could do that. At the end of the day, it was financial engineering, where they simply kind of use debt to reduce, you know, the cost of capital and increase the shareholder returns. And now everyone's kind of waking up to the fact that you're actually decreasing value, because an investor that wants to own an aviation company doesn't also want to own a healthcare company. So the investor doesn't buy those shares. And the investor that wants to own the healthcare company doesn't want to own the aviation company, so they don't buy those shares. So the way to increase shareholder value is to actually split those businesses up. And then the investors that want to own the aviation business will pay more, and the investors that want to own the healthcare business will pay more. And the overall value of those two businesses goes up by having them be separate. And that's what the market's kind of waking up to. And this is kind of a trend that's been going on for years now, you know, going back to kind of 2013, 14, where the market started to kind of rationalize some of these silly conglomerate business ideas and break them apart into more kind of, you know, targeted businesses spin-outs. That can actually spin out or breakups.
Yeah.
That can basically attract shareholders to bid on each one of those businesses individually and drive value up. You know, we saw one business I was close to that I saw this with was Dow DuPont, where they, you know, Dow merged with DuPont. And then they split into several businesses that each were focused on a particular vertical, and it made a lot of sense to drive value for the overall shareholders. So at the end of the day, you know, these conglomerates are about kind of driving economic outcomes, and the only folks that you see doing this well are folks like Warren Buffett, where the job is really about capital allocation, where, you know, you can allocate capital to the best business, and that business on its own will grow organically, versus taking a bunch of crappy, low growth, no growth businesses, levering them up to kind of juice the returns on each other. And so, we're seeing this slow unwinding happening. So I think it'll continue to, and you could probably go and pick a bunch of these conglomerates, and you'll see the activist shareholders doing this. They'll buy a bunch of shares. They'll instigate and say, hey, you guys should break up. The share price will go up by 20, 30%. So if you want a stock tip of the day, you know, go find the next set of conglomerates that are going to get attacked and broken up.
It's interesting, Chamath, and, you know, with public markets, Dell is spinning out VMware, and that's going to create a massive amount of cash and shareholder value. They're doing a huge dividend. So I guess my question to you, Chamath, is when do we start to see this hit, not from a point of weakness, but from companies that are strong and see this as, hey, this is a way to just unlock shareholder value? Will we see an Amazon spin out AWS, a YouTube or an Instagram come out of their parent companies?
I think it's very rare that these things happen on the offensive foot. I think it's typically a defensive maneuver that's driven by really poor returns over long periods of time, mm-hmm. or activist investors who want to push for value unlock.
Totally.
Yeah, like, you know, eBay, PayPal.
Totally. I was about to bring that up. I mean, do you remember how hard that eBay, I remember, like, John Donahoe was the CEO. He like fought that so hard. I remember getting a phone call from him asking if I would support them. He had rounded up Reid Hoffman and other people support eBay. And I'm like, no, I can't support.
No, do you remember this? We were in Vegas and Donahoe called and we were working on a plan. And then you went and walked Donahoe through the plan. Do you remember this thing?
No, what happened?
We were in Vegas.
You were going to try to do a hostile spin out of PayPal.
No, Donahoe either called you or called me. And I said, you should talk to Sachs. And we sketched out a plan for what PayPal should do.
I do remember that.
But
that
and like was, on yes. Saturday afternoon, we sketched out this plan.
So I told John, no, I'm sorry, I can't support you because I believe it should be spun out. And so the only two people from the original PayPal team who said that publicly were me and Elon. And we said that if you could get PayPal out from under, this sort of eBay bureaucracy, it could be a $100 billion plus company.
The bar for acquisitions is extremely high. Like, I think the last really two acquisitions that were really done well was Zuck's acquisition of WhatsApp and Instagram. But since then, the bar is extremely high for these conglomerates. So as an example, PayPal was rumored to be buying Pinterest. And, you know, there was such an incredible shareholder revolt that they had to put out a press release saying, we have absolutely no interest in acquiring Pinterest. But what that all that did was just, you know, accelerate the bleeding, because then people were saying, wait a minute, how strategically lost must you be that you would want to buy Pinterest? As and so then it, and as a result, the PayPal stock price has gotten absolutely
It was over a $300 billion company, and now it lost the entire value of Pinterest, basically.
Here's the big issue that I think we have in American economics and company building. You know, we've gone through 20 or 30 years of really underinvesting in R&D at the sake of share buybacks, at the sake of, you know, market consolidation,
dividends,
private equity, you know, driven take privates. And so all of this capital misallocation has really put us on the wrong foot. And the pandemic basically showed that we were really ill positioned. So a lot of these conglomerates, it doesn't make sense today, because we've proven that the compensation schemes for CEOs, the incentives for executive management are way too perverted, and they just create horrible outcomes. A different example I saw in the last, I think, 15 or 20 years, IBM's market cap has gone down to $113 billion. In the meantime, they've bought back $132 billion of stock.
What?
Could you imagine the kind of R&D that IBM could have affected with that $132 billion and where they could be? So we
They're not good capital allocators.
Well, we have horrible capital misallocation. So,
well, look at Apple. I mean,
I don't think they know how to spend the money in the R&D.
Yeah, they're not good at it. That's
they're
the
not
point.
Good at it. They're better off taking those They're better off taking those massive R&D budgets and putting it into M&A budgets, not for like a $50 billion Pinterest acquisition that doesn't make any sense, has no synergies, but on smaller acquisitions of teams that have built really interesting technology.
I mean, look, IBM could have bought a lot of different things.
They don't seem to know how to innovate or operate. Those guys don't seem to know how to do anything. Totally. So like,
my point is, now we're in this cycle where these conglomerates will get ripped apart so that a brighter, fresher, and probably younger group of executive management can take a different spin on these companies and actually do some. So for example, like the J&J spin out is really exciting, because you take med devices and pharma and you separate it from a really struggling, complicated consumer goods, you know, package business, you know, the shampoo, the Q-tips, the Listerine, get all that off balance sheet. Now you can actually, you know, make drugs and med devices. And that's a really interesting business that the right CEO can really do a lot of interesting things with.
I heard an interview with the CEO of GE, I think Culp, who was putting forward this plan. The line that I remember that kind of resonated with me, he said, the benefits of focus are immediate. The benefits of synergy are hypothetical. And I think that's really the key point here. And it's what's going to fuel all this sort of deconglomeration, is that the benefits of focus to a company are so huge that, you know, that, but the reason why it doesn't happen is because of this instinct that all these managers have for empire building, right? So when times are good, they can keep building their empires, and then something bad has to happen to force them to focus.
The motivation, they're not owners. They're typically not founders. And so what you end up seeing is their comp goes up linearly with market cap. So the bigger
And this is just to close the thought out on that whole eBay PayPal thing. I mean, it was so obvious that eBay should spin out PayPal, but the management resisted it, and it took an activist shareholder. I think Icon came in
there.
It was Icon who came in there.
Yeah, when Carl Icahn is in the lobby, you're fucked.
Well, but Icahn shouldn't have to come in there. The reason why there's opportunity for Icahn is the managers won't do the right thing.
He unlocked $250 billion of value. He was incredible.
No, I mean, they spun that out for $40 or $50 billion. Now it's worth five times that amount.
It's $250 billion.
Yeah, it's crazy. And just to put this all in perspective, the stock buybacks that are going on right now, Apple did almost $20 billion last quarter. They've done $77 billion last year. And you want to talk about the impact of tax policy on innovation? Well, you've got on one hand here, Apple is looking at, well, I'm going to have to pay all these taxes. I might as well just increase the amount I'm buying back and be neutral. Why would I want to show any kind of a profit here? I'll just buy back as many shares as possible. The company will eventually be private. I mean, you got to be really careful with how you do this, because there's no incentive for people now to put money into R&D or other stuff. They'll just buy back the stock, might be the most efficient thing to do, correct? In terms of like the share.
If you don't know how to spend the money.
It's the dumbest thing to do. It basically shows you're an idiot.
Well, it shows you got nothing better to spend the money on. So maybe buying back the stock is better than frittering it away. But yeah, it means you're out of ideas. It means you're out of ideas.
Or a combination of, my God, this core business is throwing off so much money that we can't come up with enough ideas at that time. I think that's
also part of it. No, it just means you're not ambitious enough.
I mean, what would you spend $20 billion on? I mean, Zuck is having a hard time spending $10 billion on creating the metaverse a year. I mean, you're talking about $80 billion a year. What would you put that towards? What should Apple put it towards?
No, Apple could even more aggressively double down to enter the car market. They could have done it much sooner than they have.
They could spend 20 a year on that. Sure. You're right.
You know, easily. They could actually enter, I don't know, power. They could.
Their culture is to have very few products as a company. They're always very proud of that. It's the Steve Jobs focused thing. I mean, I think it's worked pretty well for them. I know you're second guessing it. The thing that I hear.
No, I just don't like buybacks because I think it comes at the sake of R&D. For most companies, I think
it's
obviously
an easy choice.
The big tech companies are different, but everybody else, what you see is R&D is like 1 or 2% of their, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a shame.
Look, Apple could definitely be more aggressive, but I wouldn't judge the Tim Cook era until we see what happens with glasses, because this is the product that I hear is coming is going to be their AR glasses, and that's going to be a new computing platform that they open up to developers. And I guess Cook's been there for what, a decade, but I think he doesn't want to retire until this comes out and he can see this is going to be his signature product, I think. But I'll tell you, just the other thought that just went through my head as I saw this news about GE, it really was kind of the end of an era. You got to remember that back in the 80s, 90s, I think even as late as 2000, GE was the number one company in America by market cap. It was the top of the S&P 500. It later subsequently got kicked out of the Dow Jones. But the thing that went through my head is, you know, when I was a kid growing up, the only two business names that I even knew were Jack Welch and then Lee Iacocca. You know, that was it.
You had their posters on your wall?
GE and Chrysler.
Farrah Fawcett in between the two of them.
It was Big Jack Welch and Iacocca. And now you don't even know the name of the GE guy. I mean, I know it because I watched some interview and I saw him up there. But I mean, you can't think of a business leader today who's not in tech and really a tech founder or somebody who's handed the ball by the tech founder. So we know Tim Cook because Steve Jobs handed him the ball, but otherwise it's all tech founders. You don't hear about any of these old, like Dow Jones type companies anymore. It's just the business environment, the economy has changed so much since the 80s and 90s. It's all totally dominated by tech now.
But Sax, I would argue that the disruptive business and the disruptive business leader are always the icons. Back in the day, the chemical companies were the icons and everyone knew the chemical companies and the guys running them. Then it was the industrial companies. You know, then it was kind of the financial, you know, then it were these guys in the 80s and 90s that did all the LBOs.
But Welch and Iacocca weren't founders, you know.
But they were in different ways.
Tell me the top two companies on R&D spending. Top two companies without looking on R&D
spending. In the world?
Global.
In the world.
Number one, number two. Give me number one, number two.
I'd say Microsoft is up there.
No, it depends on classification, but I would say Saudi Aramco.
Freebird, what do you got?
Yeah, I would probably put Exxon up there.
You guys need to think about who has been some of the most innovative leaders. Amazon, $42 billion in 2020.
No, but Jason, that's an accounting thing. If you're saying in the world, Saudi Aramco, their exploration, their E&P budget is probably $200 billion a year.
Okay, I guess maybe because is that a corporate entity? Technically, it wouldn't be on the list.
Yeah, it's a public company.
Yeah. So
Google's got to be spending $25 billion
a year. Alphabet is second with $27 billion.
Oh, off by two.
Huawei is third, 22. Microsoft is fourth, 19. Apple
is fifth,
18.
You're saying tech companies.
No, this is all companies. Samsung, Facebook.
Some of this is just accounting categorization.
It's accounting categorization.
Because the engineering budget is basically what goes into R&D. So the more engineers you have on staff, the bigger your R&D
budget.
Doesn't mean you're producing anything, by the way.
Bigger industrial companies, traditional companies that list things as R&D, you know, most of those dollars flow out to third-party companies like enterprise software companies, services businesses. So it doesn't end up, it gets accounted for as quote-unquote R&D because they get to capitalize it. But that spend is typically not paying in-house salaries to engineers. And that's the distinction between true tech companies and other companies that are quote unquote going through a digital transformation or, you know, have a quote unquote R&D budget. They're outsourcing R&D and typically paying three times as much and typically getting one-tenth in the return. And I think that's the maybe a good heuristic for how you might kind of want to look at what differentiates a true tech company.
Depending on accounting, Saudi Aramco spends $37.5 billion to $50 billion, depending on how
you account. All right, so that puts them at, you know, probably tied with Amazon for all intents and purposes.
That just means I was right, Jason. That's what I care about.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering. Well, you know what? The reason I think that they might not be listed is because they're kidding. No, no, it's a really good insight.
Jay Cowell was reading a BuzzFeed article and
it was Barron's. It was Barron's. Yeah. But anyway, putting it aside, I think the issue might be that they are recently public, right? So maybe they've only been filing public for 2 years or something. All right. I think that's everything. How's everybody doing otherwise? How's everybody's personal life? Are people losing their mind? What's people's plans for the end of COVID?
I'm going to go have beer and pizza on the beach.
Nicely done.
So I'm ready to get out of here.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, I'm exhausted. Are you guys exhausted? This has been a fucking crazy run.
I don't know what day it is anymore. I'm ready
to wind the year down.
I am so exhausted. I mean, this has been the craziest pace I've ever experienced in my life. The number of deals going on, the amount of inbound.
Oh my God. I tell you, at that conference, so I have all these founders come up to me and pitch me what they're doing. A couple of them, I'm like, that sounds really interesting. Can we participate in that? It's like, no, none of the rounds are subscribed. I'm like, why'd you come up to me and pitch me this then?
How dare you? What?
Yeah. So
rule number one.
I tweeted a new terms of service. This is only if I'm at a conference. Okay. If you set up an appointment in my office, it's fine. That's like an opt-in. But like, if you come up to me to pitch me your idea at a conference, then, and I say, okay, I want to invest, like give me an allocation. Like, don't come to me and pitch me if you're not going to give me an allocation.
Yeah, no, that's not cool. That's like being like, oh my God, I know the best restaurant in the world. It's open tonight. They've got the greatest steak. And you're like,
Jason,
okay, I'll go.
Jason,
like, no reservations.
Guys, tell Sax about the white truffles from yesterday.
No, well, hold on. Oh, yeah, we had dinner at Chamath's house last night. It was incredible. So he got these white truffles from
Best
Alba.
Best meal I've had in a year.
I mean, it was really incredible. Pretty I really appreciated great. It. It was amazing.
And 2000, like it was 1996 white burgundy, Leroy
the,
and
the white burgundy 2009.
Yeah,
I mean, they're amazing. I'm not a wine drinker. I'm not saying that your chef beat Sax's from 2 weeks ago.
Wasn't Sax's chef your old chef, Chamath?
I think one of his chefs. David lives in a stratosphere of burn. He lives in a stratosphere of burn that's just at a different. He's next level.
Chamath, are you eating my sloppy seconds? What's going on over there?
No.
I think you got to beat that one out. I don't know that term means what you think it means anymore, Sax.
But by the way, there was a dinner conversation last night, Sax. To your point, Chamath, it's up to you to decide if you want to disclose the dinner conversation guest. But this guy said that there was a guy that applied to Y Combinator that had $750 million in crypto. And so he's like applying to Y Combinator with his
750K
for 150K to give up some percent of his company.
7%.
And they're like, all these stories of these guys are like, I will pre-fund my own Series A with $15 million to create this business inside of the YC machine.
That was incredible.
There's such an incredible, like inexplicable, undescribed, I think, in the mainstream media story of crypto wealth creation that's been going on. And these crypto, these crypto 100 millionaires, billionaires are emerging and doing their own kind of innovation completely under the radar right
now. The smartest people that we know are selling right now.
Yeah, and I think they changed their conversions for the YC safe. They're now getting preferred shares. They used to do common. And I think it happens post-conversion. So they want their 7% fixed, you know, after your next round of funding is my understanding. I don't know if that's, but yeah, so they got it more aggressive. But
that's brutal.
It's a, you know, what's happening is like the accelerators have to move earlier back to incubators. So the idea of somebody, you know, Grin or some of the other companies we funded coming to the accelerator with 20,000 or 50,000 in revenue. In some cases, they may be able to raise money without. And certainly the crypto companies are raising $25 million. They're outpacing regular companies, regular startups, non-crypto startups. And they raise it in 10 seconds from a bunch of ETH for buying tokens. They've created a whole shadow economy that doesn't have to play by any of the
rules. Do you really need venture anymore? Like,
well, if you want to obey the law, I guess you do. But in a lot of these cases, like
I did this.
This whole new economy could emerge completely offline, right? Completely off the
SEC and Gensler do want to get this thing tightened up. They don't want people doing this.
I'm not surprised.
I think it was 2015. I presented Amazon at Irisone. And one of the things that I did was we calculated what Bezos's investment track record was, right? Because he basically took all his free cash flow and reinvested it in the business, and you could measure what his return on invested capital was. And it was like 42%, and on a really big number, on tens of billions of dollars.
You're saying his IRR on the money Amazon deployed in R&D projects like the Kindle or AWS. It was about
42% over like a multi-decade period. And
double what a venture firm would do, or top venture firm.
I mean, he's in a class by itself. But my takeaway in that moment was, wow, this is the smartest investor of our generation. That's what I said to Bezos at the time. And, you know, Bezos had a track record of selling roughly $1 billion of Amazon stock every year. And this year he, snap sold $6.6 billion.
Which, when we talk about the percentage you're selling, we're talking about selling 5%, 10%. So, they're not diluting their whole positions, but these are big numbers. You're right.
I think it's a signal.
JKL, you got to close this out?
All right, everybody. It's been another amazing episode. Episode 55 of the All In Podcast from... where people are coming from. The All In Summit will be in the spring at some point. I'm going to go to Miami and look at the locations.
Oh, March 11th through 15th. I can't because I'm playing poker.
Yes. Okay. You got your poker trip.
In an undisclosed location. What? Big time poker.
I can go. Listen, is there any way I can deal? Can I deal the game?
Poker. Big boy
you
poker.
You need to have a funny guy there. I mean, I'm not a great dealer, but can I be a waiter or something?
I mean, I think the game starts at 2,000, 4,000, but it could get a little spicier.
We spicy.
Zach, you've had a good year. Maybe you should go.
Yeah, maybe you should have Solana play. Get the Solana chips in play.
Oh, he can play. David can play.
Zach has had a lot of weak
here's what
here.
You do. You chip off 10 milli in Solana. You put it in LLC. And then you buy into the game. And then
That may not be enough.
All right, 20. Whatever.
20 is enough.
For the Queen of Quinoa, the Dictator, and Rain Man, David Sachs, I'm Jay Cal. We'll see you next time on the All In Pod. Subscribe to the channel.
We'll let your winners ride.
Rain Man, David Sachs.
And instead, we open source it to the fans, and they've just gone crazy with it.
Love you, West. Nice. Queen of Quinoa. Besties are gone.
I hope they're dead. That is my dog taking a noise in your driveway. Sacks.
One big huge orgy because they're all just useless. It's like this like sexual tension that they just need to release somehow.
Wet your feet. Wet your feet.
Wet your feet.
That's gonna be, we need to get merch.
Besties are back. I'm going all in.